Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you grew up listening to Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, and the other folk music greats, you have something in common with Jody Rattler, the protagonist of Lucky, the most recent novel by Jane Smiley. We meet Jody when she is 6 years old. It's 1955, and she is growing up in St. Louis, Missouri. We meet her on a day that shapes her idea of who she is in a profound way. And then we follow her through the decades until we reach present day. Jody Rattler shares quite a few autobiographical details with her creator, who also grew up in St. Louis. In fact, it's tempting to think that the novel is semi-autobiographical until you realize that the tall, awkward girl the main character went to high school with is actually Jane Smiley herself.
Excuse me. She's the gawky girl.
All right. The gawky girl the main character went to high school with is actually Jane Smiley herself. Jane Smiley is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. She also got her PhD at Iowa and taught at Iowa State University for 15 years. She was at ISU when she won the 1992 Pulitzer Prize for fiction for her epic novel, A Thousand Acres. And she'll be at the Iowa City Public Library at 2 p.m. on Sunday, April 28th. She is with me now. Welcome, Jane.
Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to talk to you again. And why don't you start off by introducing us to Jody Rattler?
Okay, I'll just read the first paragraph. And I hope I read it correctly. When I was 6 and my uncle was 24, he did something that you can't do anymore. He took me to a racetrack across the river called Cahokia Downs. That was where I saw horses for the first time. It was 1955. We didn't have a television yet, so I never watched Roy Rogers or My Friend Flicka. I had no idea why we were there or what we were supposed to do, but Uncle Drew held my hand, bought me an ice cream cone, walked around when the horses were being mounted, and shouted when they were running. After we had been there a while, he handed me a piece of paper and a pencil and told me to circle some numbers. I circled 4, then 2, then 8. He then handed the paper to a man behind a window along with $6. He later told me it was his last $6, but I never believed that. He got another piece of paper back and we went to our seats. We sat quietly, jumped up and down for the race, and then he grabbed my hand and took me back to the window. He handed in the piece of paper, and the man counted out his winnings, $5,986, all in 20s and $2 bills. My uncle was grinning from ear to ear.
And he gives her the $86.
Yes.
In $2 bills.
Because he doesn't want anybody to know that that's where he got the money.
So this is a day that really shapes Jody's idea of who she is. She was lucky that day, and she comes to think that she's just a person who is lucky.
Yes. I mean, she is lucky in a lot of ways. Her uncle is very kind to her. She wins the money, and she would say, I'm not sure I would agree with her, but she would say that every time some challenge comes up, she has a little piece of luck and it enables her to move forward and do what she wants to do.
What was your inspiration for this book? I mean, I mentioned that you share some autobiographical details with your main character, but what made you want to write this novel in particular?
Well, the first inspiration was that when I was in 2017, when I was in St. Louis for my 50th high school reunion, I was interviewed and a guy asked me if I had ever set a book in St. Louis. And I thought about it and I realized, no, I'd set part of private life in parts of Missouri, but I hadn't set anything in St. Louis. I could not believe that because I grew up there. I really enjoyed growing up there. And I think St. Louis is a really interesting city. So I thought, well, what could I set there? And I thought, well, I could write an autobiography. And I thought, oh, how boring is that? And then I thought, oh, I have an idea. And so since I love music and have always loved music, and one of my favorite memories of St. Louis is just lying in bed at night listening to my stack of records play. You know, my mom didn't seem to mind, so I just listened to them, and it was really fun. So that gave me the idea of doing a sort of semi-autobiographical depiction of me if maybe I had been a musician.
And Jody becomes a musician. She loves music. Her mother was a performer on Broadway and loves music, and her grandparents love music. So this is something that's part of her family life. But she ends up becoming a folk singer when she is in college. And I think that, you know, when you describe that every time she comes up against a challenge, there's this little bit of luck. She does seem to have things come to her easily, but she also lets things go easily. She has this interesting approach to life where, you know, she'll put forth a little bit of effort, something good will happen, but she doesn't seem to follow up on it.
Well, I think she has a sort of reticent quality. And although I think she's ambitious in some ways, one of her pieces of luck is that her uncle is in the money business, and he takes care of her finances. So when she looks around, let's say, at the music business and realizes how stressful it is for a lot of her fellow musicians, she doesn't need to go down that road because her uncle has taken such good care of her finances. And I'm not going to tell too much about her, but it's the same kind of thing with, you know, the guys she meets and the ones that she cares about.
Well, and I do want to talk a little bit about that. One of the things that I'm sure a lot of people who read this book will relate to, but she and you kind of straddled a huge, huge cultural shift when she was coming of age, because, you know, we meet her when she's 6 years old in 1955, and then she goes to college. And, you know, here we have the big folk movement, we have the sexual revolution, and she lives through all of this. But she was incredibly sheltered and naive when it comes to sex. And she's living in this moment where there are many girls who are like her and many girls who are not like her at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think her whole way of living is to kind of make the best of what's going on in her life. And she's attracted to her fellow musicians, and she's attracted to other people too. But I don't know. She has to figure out with each step of the way whether she wants to go down a particular, you know, path. She's an only child, and I don't think that she ever learns how to, in some sense, give up her privacy in the way that people with a lot of brothers and sisters would do. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, but I think that that's just her way of talking to herself about how to go down the next path.
I found how she received her sexual education to be really interesting. I've had a lot of people tell me stories over the years, you know, like I learned about sex from reading romance novels or this or that. And she learned about sex from eavesdropping on her roommates and then from some candid conversations with another roommate who grew up on a farm.
Well, in some ways, that's how I learned too. That part has always made me laugh. Because when I started out at Vassar, we had an orientation. And part of the orientation, which I think was several days, part of the orientation was about some kind of sex stuff. I don't even remember what that was. But when we got back to our room that night, I said to my roommate, "So what's blah, blah, blah?" And she said, she just laughed. And she told me all about it. It took her about two nights, but my eyes were open. See, I never dated in high school, so I didn't have any experience.
In writing about her sexual experiences, she does become sexually empowered. Yeah. And of course, you know, this was a reflection of the times that she lived in. But did it feel important to you to write about that, given the current environment that we're living in today politically?
No, it mostly felt that she had to have some way of learning about relationships. Especially relationships with men, because she had not grown up with brothers. She had one cousin, but and I thought that I wanted to explore that aspect of her life.
Let's take a short break right now, and we'll be back in just a moment. I am talking with Jane Smiley. Her most recent novel is Lucky. It's about a young woman named Jody Rattler. Well, she's a young woman when we meet her, but we follow her throughout her entire life. She becomes a fairly well-known folk singer and has a number of fascinating experiences throughout the years. And the novel ends in present day. Jane Smiley will be in Iowa City. She'll be at the Iowa City Public Library at 2 p.m. on Sunday, April 28th. The novel is Lucky, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour is Jane Smiley. She has just published her most recent novel. It's called Lucky, and it's about a woman named Jody Rattler who shares a lot of autobiographical details with Jane Smiley herself. She grew up in St. Louis in the 1950s and 60s. The book is also inspired by a lot of the folk music of the 1960s and 70s. The main character, Jody Rattler, becomes a folk singer herself. And Jane Smiley will be in Iowa City on Sunday, April 28th. She'll be at the Iowa City Public Library at 2 p.m. And Jane, just before the break, we were talking about Jody as she is coming of age. She goes to college, and this is really during the late 60s. Things are changing pretty radically during this time. And I want to talk about the music, because music is such an important part of this book. You write about so many different songs, so many different artists, and then we also see Jody creating her own music, writing her own songs. I know that you play the banjo. Are you also a songwriter?
I'm not going to say that I actually play it, but I play it sort of.
Well, there's a picture on the back of the book of you playing the banjo, so physical evidence.
Yes, that's true.
So all of these songs that Jody writes throughout the book, there are so many different song lyrics. Did you write them all?
Yes.
When you were writing the novel, or were they collected over time?
No, I wrote them as I was writing the novel. As I was following her through the, her life that I imagined. I let the songs just sort of come into my mind and have them, which is what the folk songs of the 60s and 70s did. They had a relationship to the lives of the singers and the writers. They weren't just old songs that they updated or something like that. And that was a fun part for me. I really enjoyed it.
Were you listening to a lot of music at the same time that you were writing?
Oh, yeah. I always listen to a lot of music.
What were you listening to when you wrote this book?
Oh, I don't even know. One of the things that I do is ask Alexa, you know, that person from, you know, where I ask her to play songs from, say, 1968 or 1964 or 1971. And then I listen to the songs that just pop up. And a lot of them are ones I'm familiar with. But the great thing about a lot of songs, especially when they're beautifully performed, is that they're simultaneously familiar and surprising. And so you think about them as you've heard them before, but you also appreciate new things like harmony or something that you've sort of forgotten about.
Do you actually listen actively while writing, or is that a place you turn for inspiration?
I don't listen while I'm writing because that would be distracting. But yeah. I listen while I'm cooking, while I'm driving, you know, while I'm just sitting around. I just listen whenever I get the chance.
You mentioned before exploring your main character, Jody Rattler's relationships with people. And something that we see her do is sort of, you know, move into a relationship and then slide out of it. She tends to not, at least especially with her first few relationships, she's not assertive. She's not taking control of a situation. Relationships start, and she may be surprised that they start, and then they end, and she may be surprised that they end. But she kind of lets people come and go from her life, and not just lovers. We also see her doing that with friends, where she'll make a connection with other women, but kind of let that slide as well. And there's a moment that happens in the novel. She's at a cabin that she's bought in the Catskills, and a bird flies into the cabin. And at that moment, when she sees this bird trapped in her cabin, she kind of has this personal epiphany about isolation. Tell me what you wanted us to take away from that moment.
Well, one of the things that's characteristic of her, and maybe this is because she's an only child, and maybe it's because she doesn't have a very good relationship with her mother. But she's let's call her an introvert. And she's a little bit suspicious, you know, I mean, when she's walking down the street or something like that. And she hasn't been trained by her mother and her grandparents to, say, smile as she's walking down the street. Her mother, you could say, has trained her to be a little suspicious and a little nervous. And so it takes her a while to get into relationships. And then when she's in the relationship or the friendship or whatever it is, she pretty much leaves it to the other person to pursue it. And I think she sees that as a kind of freedom. And then freedom has its downside too, which she realizes, you know, about two-thirds of the way into the novel.
And we see her make an effort to make connections. And that resonated with me in a lot of ways, and not just from my own life, but I observe a lot of people who do find themselves as they age suddenly being socially isolated. And we even, right now, our society, it's been described that we have an epidemic of loneliness in our society. And yet we don't seem to value friendships like we value the other relationships in our lives. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it depends on the person, because some people, they connect with a lot of other people. They're used to it, and then they're very sociable. Other people, and I would include myself as one of those, they like other people. They like being near other people. And I'm a really good eavesdropper. And I love listening to what people have to say. But it's difficult for me to participate in the conversation. And unless I'm invited, and then I do participate. But I think people vary in their ways of being sociable. And each way of being sociable has its own advantages. I mean, for me, just being an eavesdropper, just being watching things gives me ideas for writing books. But on the other hand, if you're writing books all the time, you don't have a whole lot of time to spend with other people.
Have you had to force yourself to try to maintain those connections?
I did when I was a kid. Now I maintain the connections. But my husband is more sociable than I am, so it's partly his function to help maintain those connections. But he was a realtor before he moved to California, so he had to be sociable, so he's got the habits.
So you mentioned being inspired to write a book that takes place largely in St. Louis by going back for your high school reunion. Mm-hmm. And you write so lovingly about St. Louis and about the neighborhoods and the different streets and the different houses and the parks and the culture in so many ways. Did you write that from memory, or did you go back to St. Louis and spend some time?
No, I did go back to St. Louis and spend some time, but mostly I wrote it from memory. One of the things I love about St. Louis is the weird street names. And so I made sure one day, a few years ago, I was walking around Forest Park and I walked down this road called Skinker, and I saw a wonderful golden brick house on the not on the corner, but almost to the corner. And I looked at that house and I said, I want that house. And then I said, no, I don't want that house. But my St. Louis character, she's going to be born in that house. But the fun thing is that it's named Skinker,
Right. Right. Well, I love the part where Jody was writing a song and she was incorporating street names from St. Louis. It didn't sound very melodic.
Yeah, there's so many weird ones. I mean, to me, why would you name a prosperous town Creve Coeur, which means broken heart, But I just like St. Louis, and I like the landscape. I like how the only thing I don't like about St. Louis, and you can relate to this in Iowa, is the humidity.
Yes, although it's as humid as it is in Iowa, St. Louis has us beat. Hands down.
That's
I'm talking
true.
With Jane Smiley. Her most recent novel is Lucky. And one of the things that you write about is as Jody is growing up, she goes through, becoming politically aware. She lives through the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was a moment where really everyone in the country believed, and we were on the verge of a nuclear war. And felt our own mortality. I didn't live through that, but I grew up 25 years later, but we certainly, kids of the 70s and 80s, we thought that we were going to die in a nuclear holocaust for sure. Mm-hmm. You really paint that feeling so vividly. Is that something that you think about, those times when life felt so precarious when you were younger?
Yes. I mean, that part is pretty much autobiographical. In the book, Jody does say that she talked to the gawky girl about the Cuban Missile Crisis, or she overheard her. I don't exactly remember. But my stepfather did say to me when I said, if they bomb us, are we going to flee to the countryside? And he said, no, it won't be worth it. And that really stuck in my mind. And, you know, how old was I? I was like 13 or something like that. And then it seemed like things were just getting worse and you just never knew what might happen. And you had to get used to it. But at the same time, it was always present. And then, you know, and then the Kennedys were killed. It just seemed like it was just one thing after another.
When the novel reaches present day, you also talk about how it's one thing after another. And I don't want to give anything away, but I am curious from a personal perspective, does now this moment in time feel as apocalyptic to you as those times?
Well, I would have maybe said yes, but in another way a few weeks ago. But now I've read all this stuff about, you know, China and Russia and, you know, well, maybe it is in the same way. But I'm very anxious for the sake of my kids and grandkids about global warming and all of the things that are going to happen if nothing is done. So, yeah, I feel like we're living in a dangerous time, and I just hope that people will come along and say, okay, we can fix this and actually do it.
You are in your early 70s. What keeps you writing? What compels you at this point?
I would say curiosity, because it's not just curiosity about things that I see and overhear and watch on the news or something like that, but it's also curiosity about how a story, when you put it together, how it plays out. It's like solving a complicated puzzle. And I really like that aspect of it.
You're so incredibly prolific. Does that feel almost like, I mean, you've written a book or novel almost every year. Does that feel like something that you need to keep doing?
Yes. I mean, I really enjoy it. It's my game, but it's also a thought process. And I like both those aspects about it. One of the books that I wrote was called Good Faith. And it was about, and I just met my husband, my current husband at the time, and it was about issues that had changed his life back on the East Coast when he was a realtor. And I told him, you know, if we write a book about that, I'll write it. You just tell me what happened and I'll figure it out how to set it up. What the book will do it'll make sense of what happened in a way that you can understand it. And then maybe if we've done that, you can put that behind you. And that turned out to be true. And I think that's what plotting is for. It's for making sense of something. And then once you've figured it out, you don't have to think about it a lot anymore.
Is this the first time you have written yourself as a character in one of your novels?
More or less, I would say. Yeah.
All right. So maybe not quite as overtly before.
Yeah. I've done some wishing in the young adult novels, which are about, and three of them are about a little girl who really wants a horse. And that's me. I mean, but it's set in a different place and she has different family life than I did. But you know, this is the one, probably the closest, yeah.
Well, Jane, it has been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And I would never call you gawky.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Jane Smiley. We have been talking about her most recent novel, Lucky. I will be chatting with her again at the Iowa City Public Library on Sunday, April 28th at 2 p.m. This is an event sponsored by the Iowa City Public Library and Prairie Lights Bookstore. Admission is free. Doors open at 1 o'clock. You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people are gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful as you feel. Coming up, once beloved, now reviled, how calorie pears became invasive, and some new advice on how to take on garlic mustard. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is a time of year when most of us are enjoying the first blossoms of spring, but some of the blossoms out there are sources of stress. For example, I saw garlic mustard flowering over the weekend, and in a few minutes, I will talk with Kathy McMullen about new research and changing advice about how to respond to garlic mustard. But first, it wasn't very long ago that planting Bradford pears seemed like a really good idea, but things have changed dramatically. In fact, in Polk County Conservation is offering what they call an invasive buyback program. If residents cut down one or more calorie or Bradford pear trees or burning bushes, they will provide one native replacement tree or shrub or to plant for free, although you do need to apply to take advantage of that program. So, here to help us understand how an ornamental tree has become a terrible nuisance is Jan Thompson, Moral Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Welcome back to the show, Jan.
Thank you.
Now, like I said, planting Bradford pears seemed like a pretty good idea not that long ago. In fact, a lot of people recommended them. So tell me why people were planting them not so long ago.
Well, yeah, in fact, not so long ago, might be yesterday, actually, unfortunately. But they're a beautiful tree for spring flowering. Many of the cultivars, so it's actually calorie pear is the species, but there are a number of cultivars, and several of them will turn, the foliage will turn a bright red in fall. And so you have the advantage of a beautiful spring display of floral resources, and then in the fall, a beautiful fall color. So they were very popular, and they weren't on our radar as recently as the early 2000s, honestly, as being a problem.
Well, and the Bradford pear, which is a calorie pear, I mean, one of the attractive things about it was that it was supposed to be non-fruiting. It was supposed to be sterile so that it wouldn't spread, right? Or make a mess.
Right. And that is no longer the case. So unfortunately, all of these flowering pears do bear fruit. And normally, like if you see that fruit and you take a look at it, it's very hard. It looks, you know, kind of like a very miniaturized pear, but it's a very firm seed, and it's a little hairy like a pear. And unfortunately, after the first frost, that softens that seed coat, and they become very popular among birds in the fall. And so birds eat those fruit in the fall. And that's, you know, one of the things that we talked about last time was one of the things that contributes to a plant becoming invasive can be the fleshy bird dispersed fruits.
And when you are traveling around central Iowa, all of Iowa, are you seeing calorie pears that have just popped up in fields and ditches and a lot of places where nobody ever intended for them to be?
You know, I don't want to admit this, but no, okay. It's not as, so I know they're out there, but it was not something that I was looking for until fairly recently. As I say, I know they're out there. In the spring, they get kind of mixed in. We have a lot of native flowering species that are also easy to spot, you know, from a car window or you know, as you're traveling around the state. And so it's a little confusing, to be honest, especially if the pair are just kind of getting started. When they're smaller, they're really easy to kind of confuse for other things.
And if you look around online, you can see full fields full of them in some areas. So we do know that this can become a really big problem.
We do.
All right. So I see them in town all over the place because people have planted them purposely in places where it's hard to plant trees, like that little strip on the edge of a parking lot, things like that. So if there are Callery pears or Bradford pears in a place like that, are you recommending that it's time to cut them down?
If you have the choice, I think we do need to, you know, and that's where Polk County is coming from, is that we need to eliminate the source here, and the source is the seed. And the only way to eliminate the seed really is to eliminate the seed bearing plant, unfortunately. That's the best way to handle it. One thing that happened, so a lot of people are still quite downhearted about all of the destruction related to the derecho. But the other thing about pear trees is they're very weak wooded and prone to falling apart, basically, in a gale. maybe even today, some are coming apart. But the derecho, I know, took out a lot of these. And my neighbors had, three in the corner, which were planted to mark the corner of their property. And they just came right down. Some of these got cleaned up for us.
Right. And that's another thing that makes them less attractive than we thought they might be. But I think that so many people feel like, you know, when they realize, oh, I've planted a tree that's an invasive species that is causing problems, people feel bad. But I mean, this was very common practice.
Yeah. And I don't think anybody had any idea that it would become a problem. As you mentioned, the earliest trees that were imported were thought to be sterile. And it was only later that we learned that they bore fruit that actually could germinate. So it was an honest mistake. We use many, 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 you know, non-native plants in our landscapes. And by and large, most of them are fine to use. And that's what we were thinking about the Callery pears, was such a beautiful tree. Some of the cultivars are small, or they're columnar, so you can fit them in those narrow, spots like you were mentioning, or just to mark the corner of a yard. They were, thought to be of a nice tree for the landscape. And we honestly did not see them until maybe in the mid, 2000, maybe 2004, 2005-ish, they started showing up places that we wouldn't want them. So, and it's a thing that I think happened further east from here before it happened here. They started noticing Callery pear. I think Ohio is one of the states that regulated it fairly early on. Illinois and Indiana kind of joined in on that. Minnesota and Missouri are now trying to limit the use of it. I haven't seen in the other states a program like they have in Polk County, but that's admirable. I wanted to note that they insist if you apply that you actually submit a photo of the tree you cut down in order to get the replacement tree. I thought that was, they want proof that you really have taken it out of
right.
the landscape.
Well, and they're also including burning bushes in that. And that's another ornamental, beautiful bush that turns out to be invasive and has been spreading quite aggressively. So just briefly, we only have about a minute here. What are some native alternatives, or at least non-invasive alternatives, that can fill these gaps in our landscape that we may create if we take out the invasives?
Yeah. And, you know, this spring, just looking around, you can see a lot of other beautiful flowering plants. The ones that are flowering already, the mini crab apples. I'm not aware of any problems with any of the crab apple varieties. And there are a large number of those. Wild plum is a beautiful flowering plant with an early flower. You have to be a little careful with that one. You have to tend it or it will spread and be quite aggressive. Redbud is another really beautiful plant, although it doesn't go all the way to the northern edge of the state. Elderberry is a more of a shrub-like plant, but still has a beautiful cluster of blooms on it. Downy serviceberry is one of my favorites. It blooms a little later. It's called serviceberry because they would decorate graves with the flowers of those when they could dig them after the ground softened in spring. So they usually flower and bear a berry a little bit later in spring.
All right. So some great native alternatives. Jan, thank you so much for talking with me.
You bet. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Jan Thompson, Morrill Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And now we're going to talk about garlic mustard, a species that was introduced from Europe in the 1800s. It spreads rapidly. It's very difficult to control. It prefers shaded or semi-shaded areas. And you've probably seen it along streams or filling in the understory of a woodland near you. For years, the recommendation has been to pull and remove the plants before they go to seed. But new research may change the way we think about an interact with this plant. Kathy McMullen is here to tell us more. She is an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Welcome back, Kathy.
Yes, good morning.
So we have seen garlic mustard seemingly take over understories in woodlands, but the new thinking is looking at this more as a symptom than the real problem. So tell me what we're now starting to think about.
Yes. So originally, it was thought that garlic mustard was a really great competitor and was displacing native species, particularly non-woody species, growing in the understory. The new research, and the way it did that was by producing what we call allelo compounds, which may be toxic to competing plants. So the new research has found a couple of things. One is that native plants and their associated, what we call mycorrhizal fungi, appear to be developing a resistance to garlic mustard allelo chemicals. And this increases with the time of exposure to garlic mustard. So the resistance increases. In addition, it appears that garlic mustard tissue or concentration of allelo compounds in the tissue may diminish as the population gets older. And this is likely due to the cost of producing these allelo chemicals. They take a lot of carbon, a lot of nutrients to produce them. And if the yields are diminishing, then selection kind of suggests it's not worth producing these anymore.
Okay. So if our plants are starting to get used to garlic mustard, what will we see happen? Is this something that, because I still see a lot of garlic mustard, Kathy.
Yes.
Will we see a change?
I think that I have some anecdotal observations about that, but I think that is something that needs more research. But if these processes are working as what I just described suggests, then you should see a decrease in garlic mustard, or maybe just sort of a stabilization of the population as the other plants
and
accommodate
it. Maybe more of a diversity of species.
Yes.
I mean, because when you see garlic mustard in an understory in a forested area, sometimes that's all you see is the garlic mustard, which is what has been so scary about it.
It is scary to see a dense stand of garlic mustard. It's alarming, particularly, you know, when you think about what's growing this time of year, the spring ephemerals, and just how much they delight us with their early spring blossoms are very beautiful. The spring ephemerals are very important, part of our ecosystem in supporting early pollinators in retaining nutrients. So, yes, it is distressing to see a dense stand of garlic mustard.
Garlic mustard, as I mentioned, came to the United States in the 1800s. It's really been in the last 30, 40 years that we've been talking about it being invasive and seeing it really invade our woodlands like this. So to go back to the idea that maybe this is more of a symptom than the real problem, what changed that has allowed garlic mustard to become so present?
Yes. So some of this new line of research is also suggesting that it's deer and native earthworms. So garlic mustard is what we call a biennial, which means it has a two-year lifespan, produces seeds in its second year. So it's 100% reliant on seed production to maintain its population. What deer do is eat large quantities of native species. They also churn up the soil and leave patches of bare soil. Non-native earthworms do the same thing. They expose bare soil. And what that means for the garlic mustard is that its seeds germinate very well on this bare soil, much better than under a layer of leaves. So it's exposing what we call a seed bed for garlic mustard spread.
All right. And one of the main ways that people have been trying to control garlic mustard is by pulling and removing. That also churns up that top layer of soil. Are
right.
we making things worse, Kathy?
Well, that's what some would say, that you know, as you pull up these plants, just like you said, you're exposing a mound of mineral soil and you are releasing those seeds from what we call the seed bank to germinate. And I know that's a kind of a controversial line of thinking, that we shouldn't be pulling the garlic mustard. I mean, I and many of my students and colleagues, we've spent hours pulling and bagging garlic mustard. So it's really quite a reversal if that's the case.
Well, and there are a lot of garlic mustard pulls scheduled for right now.
Yes.
The garlic mustard is out there. It's growing. It's flowering. A lot of groups do this to try to take back their woodlands and make space for native species. So, Kathy, I know that this is kind of new and it is controversial, but what is your advice? What should we do?
I would say if you have a new and relatively small population, go ahead and pull it. I think my recommendation, if you've got a larger population, just snip the seed heads. They occur at the top of the plant, and you can just snip them off and prevent them from maturing and entering the soil seed bank.
And when you do pull garlic mustard, you do have to remove it, right? Because it's very tenacious about rerooting.
Yeah, the idea is it may reroot, or that if the seed heads are kind of approaching maturity, they'll go ahead and mature as the plants lay on the ground, and it still will end up with those seeds in the seed bank.
All right. Well, Kathy McMullen, thank you so much for explaining this, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
Yes, it will.
Kathy McMullen, adjunct associate professor in the Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News. Our producers are Caitlin Troutman, Danny Gear, and Samantha McIntosh. We have production assistance from Maddie Willis and Kate Perez. Technical support today from Tony Sarabia and Steve Cooper. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.